The Director of Naval Intelligence, Vice Admiral Ted Branch, is now in his 9th month on the job with no access to classified information. And last November, the Navy announced that Branch was one of the officials they were investigating in the fraud and bribery scandal involving ship husbanding. Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu covers the story in this week's edition of Inside the DoD's Reporter's Notebooks.
The Navy had publicly announced that Admiral Branch was having his access to classified information suspended back in November. And this all had to do with the ongoing saga of Glenn Defense Marine and Leonard Francis, the owner of that company. We don't exactly know what Admiral Branch's involvement in that whole ship husbanding scandal and fraud scandal is, but in any case, his security clearance was temporarily suspended back then in November. The interesting thing is that's still going on in an investigation that I don't think the Navy ever imagined would drag out this long. It's been 9 months that he's had no access to classified information while he's in the position of Director of Naval Intelligence, also Navy CIO and Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance. That's 9 of the 13 months he's been on the job period. So once again, we don't exactly know what the allegations are, and the Navy doesn't know when this is going to be resolved. This is an investigation that's being handled by the Justice Department and the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, NCIS, and to hear Navy officials tell it they're kind of in the dark about the status of that investigation and precisely what the suspicions against Admiral Branch are. All that we do know about those suspicions is that they had to do with activity that happened before he was in his current position. We don't know exactly when that was, but his career history would seem to indicate that the most likely period was the period between October 2009 and October 2010. That's when he was the commander of Carrier Strike Group 1, whose area of responsibility is in the Pacific, and he would have been in the neighborhood where the shenanigans were going on. But once again, really want to emphasize, Branch at this point has not been accused formally of any wrongdoing of any kind so far. We just don't know what his involvement is. We do know that he's had no access to classified information for going on 9 months, and there's no apparent end to that in sight.
Give us a little background here. This Glenn Defense Marine issue was that this company was paying bribes in order to get inside information on the movement of ships so that it could get advantage of contracts to refuel them and so forth?
Yeah, it's a pretty huge scandal. Three Navy officers have been caught up in it and formally charged so far. The owner of the company, Glenn Defense Marine, Leonard Francis, has been charged after officials lured him to San Diego from the company's home base in Singapore. There has even been an allegation, not just an allegation, but a guilty plea by an NCIS agent who was also on the take from Francis. And his role in this is he was providing information about the investigation back to Francis on this whole bribery scandal. The way he was caught was that Navy officials within NCIS and the Defense Criminal Investigative Service began to have their suspicions, so they planted false information in the case file as sort of bait to see if that would make its way back to Francis. And indeed, it did. So that's one of the convictions that have happened so far. The broader scandal, basically, it wasn't, I don't think, so much cash bribes as Francis allegedly provided these Navy officers who were operating in the Pacific with, in some cases, prostitutes, in a lot of cases, expensive entertainment and lavish dinners, developed very close relationships with them in exchange for, as you indicated, classified information about where ships were going, what their intentions were, what ports they were going to pull into, and then, in some cases, directing those ships into ports that Francis controlled so his company could then, under less favorable terms to the Navy, get those contracts for ship husbanding services, trash removal, resupply, etc., and allegedly overcharged the Navy by millions of dollars over the course of several years.
So it's safe to say that the danger to the ships from a security standpoint of people knowing where they were going and where they would be docked and not knowing anything about this company directing them there is far outweighs the problem of the bribes themselves.
I don't know. It's hard to make a value judgment on that. Obviously, you never want classified information leaving a DoD classified network and making its way into the hands of outsiders. I don't think there's any evidence that necessarily ever put the ships or their crews in physical danger, but it very well could have. And we just don't know what the full repercussions of that might have been.
Jared Serbu is Federal News Radio's DoD reporter. And also in your column today, you talk about firm fixed price contracts, service contracting. There's a lot of ferment going on there in DoD.
Yeah, Dick Ginman, who's the Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, indicated to reporters at a recent Defense Acquisition Reform Conference that the contracting officer community within DOD is probably going to see some new guidance soon on when it is okay to use what's called firm fixed price level of effort contracts and when it's not. That comes from the fact that he, based on some recent analysis of contract data that he's done, feels like those have been being used improperly and excessively. The Federal Acquisition Regulation says that you're not supposed to use those for any contract amount of more than $150,000. When he went back into the data, he found that the department spent $1.4 billion just on that fixed price level of effort contract type in fiscal 2013. A lot of them were for relatively small amounts, but there were also some that ran into the millions of dollars. His theory on why that's been happening is because DOD's been really cracking down on another contract type, which is called time and materials. The department really does not want contracting officers to use that kind of contract unless it's absolutely necessary, because it essentially just reimburses contractors for all of their costs plus a fee and doesn't give them any kind of incentive to control costs to the government. Ginman speculates, probably with some level of evidence, that this fixed price level of effort contract, which is actually pretty similar to time and materials in a lot of ways, has been used as essentially a workaround against those edicts that say don't use time and materials anymore. So some new guidance coming on that, reiterating basically what the FAR already says, that this is for $150,000 or less, and it's really only supposed to be on research and development type contracts where at the outset you really have no idea what kind of work needs to be done.
I mean, water seeks its own level, so if you tell people this is the type of contract, and the White House has been doing this also with sure. civilian agencies, this is the type of contract we really want to cut back on, this is the kind we want to emphasize, and now they find that when agencies actually do it, it's not all that much moonlight and roses.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, you can say that, you know, more guidance would help. It may also be a training issue. We hear that a lot. It's hard to say exactly how the government in general is going to get contracting officers to use their favored contract types in all circumstances and all situations. The answer is probably it ain't going to happen ever.
I guess the question then is that billions of dollars that they spent on those contracts, does anyone have any analysis of what it would have been had they been time and materials or some other kind of contract?
Yeah, I don't think we know the answer to that. We don't know. Based on the data, he may have a better idea than what he said publicly, but I don't think we know at this point what the breakdown within that $1.4 billion is. And maybe they were actually used appropriately, but one thing we know for sure is that many, many of them were far beyond that $150,000 threshold, which is there as a safeguard, really, to make sure that you're not using this type of contract for large amounts.
Now, the core of contracting officers in military has been shrunken up somewhat over the last number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like maybe they have problem where people that are overworked just default to what they're told to do without any real discretion.
Remember when the first edition of Better Buying Power came out, there was guidance on what to use, on what sorts of contract types people should be using. And the reaction in a lot of the contracting community in DOD was, okay, this is gospel, we have to do this. They had to come out in the second version of Better Buying Power and say, okay, look, this is a guide to help you think. It is not doctrine. This is, you know, supposed to help you do some analysis of what the correct thing to do in every situation is. And as Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, says often, there are no school solutions to a lot of these problems. It really is literally rocket science.
And here's a wild card question for you. Do we know anything about the shape of the defense budget for 2015 as it's in suspended animation at this point in Congress? And the passbacks that are supposed to be coming for 2015, are there any smoke signals from which we can derive any prediction of what it's going to look like?
There really aren't, and I think we have to wait until Congress gets back into session from their August recess to begin having any sort of answers to those questions. We've got defense appropriations bills and authorizations bills in both houses that are wildly different, I think you could say, from DOD's own budget proposals. Those are going to have to be reconciled at some point. I think the broad consensus is that across government, there's going to be a continuing resolution for the first part of fiscal 2015. I don't think there's going to be any exception to that for the Defense Department. So in direct answer to your question, no. know. I don't think there are any smoke signals right now. And more importantly, maybe not more importantly, but the broader question right now is what happens in fiscal 2016 and beyond? We at least have budget levels set for 2015 that DOD thinks they can probably live with. In 2016, we're back to full sequestration, and there's definitely no indication that Congress is going to alleviate those caps. So that's another pretty stark dip from 15 to 16 and beyond for the next several years for DOD, unless Congress makes, again, yet another modification to those Budget Control Act caps.
And something you reported a couple of months ago that caught, I think, a lot of ears was the fact that the budget for ongoing operations or contingency operations would continue well past the end of the conflict in Afghanistan. And so looking at the airstrikes and drone strikes and so forth going on in Iraq right now, it looks like that contingency budget could be a good thing for DOD to have included in the future years.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, as you said, DOD made it very clear in the past few months that they intend to continue asking for overseas contingency operations budgets for the several coming years after soldiers, you know, all troops are out of Afghanistan, for one reason, because there are things going on elsewhere around the world. And I think what's going on in Iraq right now, you could say, makes DOD's point, it makes the administration's point that there's going to be a continuing need for this kind of funding outside the base budget. On the other hand, you could certainly see people in Congress saying, well, wait a minute, we set up OCO for Iraq and Afghanistan. Nobody's asked us yet to spend money to have any kind of involvement in Iraq. Let's reel this back in, and then we can vote on whether or not we want to make additional appropriations for other things outside of what OCO was originally intended for. And I think you've got different voices in Congress saying different things about that. The Armed Services Committees, I think, are more receptive to the idea that OCO needs to stay in place for the next several years because it's not just about ongoing operations outside of Afghanistan. It's also about resetting equipment coming back from Afghanistan and several other operations and maintenance needs that those committees have been able to turn to OCO and use as a safety valve, sort of, in this time of budget cuts and caps in the base budget. Because remember, that overseas contingency operations account is not subject to sequestration. Congress can, in theory, put as much money as it likes into it without getting into trouble with the BCA rules that they've already set up.